Rituals are meaningful. They're practiced again and again, perhaps year after year, and they go back, way back. Archaeological digs tell us rituals may have emerged along with early modern human behaviors more than 100,000 years ago, but proving this gets really tricky. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On this hour of the morning show, we trace the course of rituals in our lives and get a better understanding of why they hold such significance. Dimitri Zigalatis is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. He also runs the Experimental Anthropology Lab. He wrote a piece in The Conversation titled, "An Anthropologist Explains Why We Love Holiday Rituals and Traditions." Dimitri, welcome to the show.
Hello, and good morning to your listeners.
Good morning. So what is a ritual, and how does it differ from, say, a tradition?
Well, the main thing that characterizes a ritual is that the goals that it serves are either not stated, so we don't really know why we do our rituals, or when these goals are stated, the means that we use to achieve those goals are not directly related. So let's say a rain dance, well, the act of dancing is not causally related to water falling from the sky.
So why might these rituals not be written down, not be very well documented?
A lot of times rituals are documented, but most of the time they're mostly based on what we do rather than what we say or state explicitly. So this is a tradition that just carries on from one generation to the next. And a very important part of these rituals is the instruction or the initiation that goes on from one generation to the next. How we show our children perform our rituals is very important for the family as a whole.
So can we use the word tradition and ritual interchangeably?
Well, rituals are traditions, but tradition can include a lot of other things that don't have to do with practices. And definitely that don't have to do with practices that are not goal-directed.
So, like, what other things might be traditions versus what might be a ritual?
Well, it might be a tradition, for example, to have a specific meal on a specific day of the year. A ritual would probably involve some specific movements, some coordination, some repetition. And if in those meals we incorporate something that doesn't have a specific goal, let's say if we agree that we have to dance around the table before consuming the meal, now that becomes a ritual.
Do rituals have more of a religious overtone to them than perhaps a tradition might?
Well, we often don't realize how full of ritual our lives are. We tend to think that this is something that earlier societies might have done more. But actually, today we have just as many rituals as ever. And they can revolve around all sorts of things, not necessarily religion. For example, when we raise our glasses to make a toast, that's most certainly a ritual. A university graduation is a ritual. A presidential inauguration is a ritual. So it expands far beyond the religious realm.
Perhaps even the way we sign off on communication, that we might have a certain ritual that we do in how we regard people.
Absolutely. A handshake, for example, is a good example of a ritual. Nobody knows why we do it. Everybody does it, and it tends to signal something. It becomes formalized. And if you don't do it in some situations, then it might be embarrassing. But we don't really know what function it serves.
And certainly when we go to other countries, there are customs that we must learn about and so that we can fit in with a culture. What about customs?
Well, anthropologists typically know that's when you know that you've really cracked the cultural code of a place. When you're able to participate in their rituals, and when you're able to no longer be surprised by their customs. Let's say if you go to Japan, you have to expect a bow instead of a handshake.
So what are the benefits of rituals? Why should we have them in our lives?
Whenever we talk about the kinds of things that have been with us as a species since the beginning of time, or for as long as we can document, then that shows that there must be some functions behind those things. So with regards to ritual, I could talk about two different levels of function that they serve. At the individual level, they can do things like they help us reduce anxiety, for example. There are a lot of scientific studies that show that to be the case. But there are also social functions that are very important. And one of the most important social functions is that rituals bring people closer together. They create social cohesion, as anthropologists call it.
So how might rituals serve as a buffer against anxiety?
Well, our brain is really averse to unpredictability. We tend to get stressed by uncertainty. And of course, we live in a world that is very complex, very hard to have control of. It is very unpredictable, very chaotic by its very nature. And rituals tend to involve things that are highly predictable. It's a specific sequence of events that is repeated exactly the same way. And even when it's not, we actually tell ourselves that it is, that that's the way we've always done it. So being able to engage in a ritual the way we've always done it actually gives us a sense of having control over our environment. And it doesn't matter if that sense is illusory or not. It actually does help reduce anxiety. And we have scientific evidence that shows that this is the case.
We're talking right now with Dimitri Zigalatas. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. He recently wrote an article for The Conversation titled, "An Anthropologist Explains Why We Love Holiday Rituals and Traditions." And you can enter into this conversation at 800-642-1234. What holiday rituals do you and your family participate in? As we move closer here to New Year's Eve, what traditions do you and your family have? How do your family rituals bring your loved ones together? And have family rituals ever caused an issue, ever caused a problem? What happened and how was it resolved? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dimitri, you write that holiday rituals are bursting with sensory pageantry. How does that sensory element, the sounds, the tastes, the feelings, how do they add to the ritual?
Mm-hmm. Well, to our brain, the sensory pageantry signals that something important is happening. And nothing really says special like sensory stimulation. Bells and whistles. And some of our holiday rituals literally have bells and whistles. They're bursting with this sensory pageantry. They include the smell of food, the taste of wine, the bright and colorful lights of the Christmas tree. All our senses get stimulated during our holiday rituals. And this sensory extravagance helps, on the one hand, it helps form lasting memories of these rituals. And on the other hand, it marks them in our brain as really special events that are worth remembering, they're worth cherishing.
I like how you use the words sensory extravagance, meaning that what's going on here is quite over the top, perhaps, or just not what we would expect day to day in our lives.
Absolutely. That's what a holiday ritual has to do. It has to mark an event as something special, out of the ordinary.
Now, many of us think of food when we think of the holidays, and it could be a grandmother or an aunt who is making a curry or a cousin's roast lamb. How does food walk hand in hand with ritual?
Food has always been part of our rituals. It's a very important element that brings people together. Since the first time our ancestors gathered around the fire to roast their hunt until today. And of course, for special occasions, we need special meals as well. So holiday meals tend to be the best kinds of meals that a culture has, and they also tend to be the most elaborate meals. And there's, of course, a reason for that. This forces, or if you will, allows family members to spend more time together. If you have to spend the entire day preparing a meal, I can guarantee you it will A, taste better, but B, it will also bring the family together because people are united in this common goal. They have to engage in this cooperative task of creating the meal, It feels like a good accomplishment when you're done after, let's say, 6 hours of roasting a pig. And there's actually a study conducted by Kathleen Voss at the University of Minnesota that showed that performing rituals before consuming food items, even as mundane as carrots, actually make food taste better to us. We perceive the food as being tastier.
Just like the earliest feasts of humans, our holiday celebrations through the centuries come with actions that are repeated year after year. The holiday feast of modern day builds family traditions, as Dimitri Zigalatis has told us. He's helping us understand holiday rituals. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What holiday rituals do you and your family participate in? It's almost New Year's Eve. What traditions do you and your family have? How do your family rituals bring your loved ones together? 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. Studies have found that traditions and rituals promote a sense of well-being and belonging. They strengthen a person's sense of history and rootedness, and they can reduce feelings of loneliness, anxiety. We're exploring holiday rituals and the significance of them. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show. Dimitri Zigalatis has researched why rituals are so powerful. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. Adding your insights on rituals as well at 800-642-1234. What holiday rituals are important to your family? Have family rituals ever caused a problem, tension? What happened? How was it resolved? And what are examples of rituals that are part of your day-to-day life? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We were talking before the news break about the idea of preparing and eating feasts, Dimitri, and how making this experience you share of preparing this long feast and sitting down together can really enhance the ritual. Many holidays also include exchanging gifts. What can we learn from gift giving about rituals?
Well, gift giving is really a brilliant system. And anthropologists know very well that they have studied ritualized gift giving in all sorts of societies, and they've documented how it plays a very crucial role in building social ties and maintaining those social ties by creating these networks of reciprocal exchange and reciprocal relationships. And we do the same today. For example, right now, I happen to be in Spain, where I'm spending the holidays with my wife's family. And for Christmas, we had this gift-giving system of the invisible friend. And the way this works is that everybody draws a lot with a name. So every person in the family has to buy one gift for another person. And nobody knows who that is, except for the one who has seen the name. And we actually cap the amount. You can't spend more than a specific amount of euros. And more or less, everybody knows what everybody else would like. So at first glance, this might just seem silly or superfluous because we're just really recycling money here. You could ask, wouldn't it be better to just go out there and buy what you want for Christmas for yourself? Well, actually, no, because if you think about it, this is a really brilliant system where most people get what they wanted in the first place or what they would buy anyway, and the money gets recycled. But at the same time, everybody still enjoys the satisfaction of giving a gift. And of course, they enjoy the satisfaction of receiving a gift. So at the end of the day, you see everybody smiling, you see everybody hugging and thanking one another, and everybody happy. And that costs virtually nothing.
But isn't there this indulgence in this type of ritual where it can become a much bigger thing when there are lots of gifts and kids are showered with gifts at Christmas? And we certainly have seen that in the commercial sector as well, where people surveyed this year said they would spend more than $1,000 on gifts, which is up significantly from last year. What about when rituals become very indulgent?
It is true that there's a lot of pressure on parents to buy expensive gifts for their kids, especially with all these commercials now and all this technology. Everybody wants an iPad or an iPhone. But I would suggest that you actually decide way in advance what gift you want to give for Christmas, and that it'd be something that you would probably buy anyway. And the holiday period can just be an excuse to spend the money at that specific time. For example, last year my wife and I saw that a very fancy coffee machine, and we decided that it was very expensive and we didn't really need it, and we would buy it at some later time. So during the holidays, we decided this was the time to buy it. So this was the present that we bought for ourselves.
Oh, and so you each knew going in that this was going to be your gift for each other.
Yes. And in hindsight, I think we would have bought this machine anyway because we really liked it. It was just a matter of time. So maybe it actually saved us some money from buying any other gift during Christmas.
Do you think that could also become a ritual where you pick out a gift that is a gift to each other that you go in together on?
A lot of families do that. A lot of families develop their own systems of gift exchange, much like the invisible friend system that I just talked about. And this becomes then a new ritual for the family, and they draw extra satisfaction from performing this ritual.
Let's bring in a call here. Let's go to Jacqueline, who joins us from Slinger. Hi, Jacqueline. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My own family tradition, which I understand kind of derives from German-American tradition, is every member of my family that I'm aware of serves pork roast and sauerkraut on New Year's, kind of an abundant meal, pretending an abundance for the new year. And I also know, because I have some Korean children, that some Koreans also prepare a whole fish for a similar reason, you know, a bounteous meal to pretend a bounteous new year. So,
well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for sharing that. And a traditional meal at New Year's, pork roast and sauerkraut. We also know, Dimitri, there's food that should bring us good luck. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. A lot of holiday meals include these kind of good luck foods. And at the same time, it also includes foods that are hard to find in many places. So they become very special for that time of the year. For example, where I'm right now, the Christmas meal includes fish and seafood. And this is a place that is very far away from the sea in the part of Spain where I'm now.
And why do you think that ritual is like that? What would compel that ritual?
Well, this is what signifies to us that this is a special occasion, right? That's what you want for a holiday, for a ritualized meal. You want something different. You want something that is hard to find. You want something that signifies lavishness. In Greece, for example, where I originally come from, Easter is the most important holiday of the year. And what every family does is that they roast an entire lamb. They spit roast it. And that, of course, takes many hours of preparation and cooking, and it allows the entire family to come around and then partake in that special meal.
Recipes also hold, I think, some ritual in them as well, as families pass down recipes and how to prepare particular food items from one generation to the next. Could you see that in terms of cooking?
Absolutely. That's very true. And that's why in many cultures, you see that these holiday recipes become secret, and they're passed down from mother to daughter or from one generation to the next, but they're never shared with outsiders because they become part of what is sacred about this tradition.
Do some traditions fall by the wayside, or do they evolve over time?
Ritual always evolves over time, but in our minds, it's unchangeable. And this is something that, as an anthropologist, I've seen again and again. When I ask people whether their rituals can change, they say no, they're unchangeable. They've always been done this way. It would be bad luck to change the ritual. You have to do it the same way. And we do it exactly the same way as it's always been done. But then you point out to some specific details. You say, well, this ritual used to involve the sacrifice of a deer, and now you sacrifice a sheep. And people will accept it. They'll say, okay, this is for practical reasons. But overall, the ritual is unchangeable. So I talked earlier about the importance of having this sense of predictability and control over our environment. And I think this adds to that. So the idea that we do things the way they've always been done, they help give a sense of power and control over our environment, and they help us ease our anxieties. They help us fight the feeling of unpredictability.
We're talking right now with Dimitri Zigalatis. He is helping us understand rituals and the significance of them in our lives and in bringing families together. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. You can join in this conversation about traditions and rituals at 800-642-1234. What family rituals are part of your life? What traditions have you passed down in your family? Are there certain traditions that are sticking and others that have gone by the wayside? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dimitri, is there research on how holiday rituals impact children when they see these rituals and partake in these rituals?
Yes, we see that these holiday rituals are very important for children. First of all, they make up some of their most cherished memories of their childhood later on. But research also shows that children who take part in group rituals and family rituals, they become more strongly affiliated with their peers or with their family. And also that having more positive memories of family rituals, it seems to be associated with more positive interactions with one's own children later on. So we see that these early memories are very crucial.
And we also have research out there that says everyday rituals, like sitting down for a family meal, even just the ritual of that, can have an impact?
Absolutely. That, again, that gives a sense of continuity and regularity and structure. But it also gives a sense of the family as being one unit. And again, this is one of the most important functional rituals, that it brings people together and it creates bonds between them.
We hear a lot about how holidays can be challenging times because we don't all agree, and sometimes we have perhaps at these really nice ritualistic feasts, there can be some pretty elevated conversation. Perhaps people who get in fights about politics and, infighting with family and friends. How can rituals help with these issues?
It's true that the holiday season is usually associated with family fights, with that cousin you almost never see and you disagree with on politics, for example. But I think rituals actually help mitigate those problems. Partaking in a meal or toasting together or dancing together or singing together does help create this collective identity rather than focus on what divides us. That's why we see that, for example, for spouses, spending those first holidays with the in-laws is really a rite of passage. That's where you expect that you're going to be judged, when you expect that you're going to see if you fit in with the family. But that's when you truly become a member of the family, when you've spent the first holidays together, when you've taken part in their rituals, because rituals are very important markers of identity. So sharing these rituals with others help us feel that we're part of a larger group that we all belong to, and perhaps at least temporarily overcome our other kinds of differences.
Speaking of a larger group that we can feel a community with, I'm thinking about graduation ceremonies and the rituals that we see in them. Also in medical physician, physician graduations, I recall white coats, going to a white coat ceremony where a young doctor in training, she or he receives a white coat, and there's a ceremony in that. What types of ceremonies do we see at graduations?
Well, this goes back to what I mentioned about rituals being going way beyond the religious sphere. Rituals are everywhere, and particularly they mark some of the most important threshold moments in our lives. And graduation, of course, is a very big moment in our life. And these rituals, they have to match the importance of the event, right? So we see in those graduation ceremonies a lot of, again, sensory pageantry. We see fancy hats and fancy dresses, and we see big crowds coming together. And we typically see things like music and dancing and communal singing or maybe communal clapping. And this really gives a sense of formality. I've often spoken with people who didn't have a graduation ceremony, and they seem to really have a sense that they're missing out on something.
Hmm. There's also that pomp and circumstance, and even the music at a graduation ceremony, all playing into the ritual.
Absolutely, and this is something that at first glance looks silly, and of course it's superfluous, but it does give a sense of formality and importance. And we even do it, think of presidential inaugurations. That's a very big ritual. And in fact, if you recall, when Obama was inaugurated, President Obama, the Supreme Court justice who administered the oath made a mistake. And there was so much uproar that he actually had to take the oath again because the ritual was not performed as it should have been.
Well, Rachel from Chicago emailed and said, every year on Christmas Eve, my family and I get together for food, drinks, and my favorite part, a talent show. We use this moment to just appreciate each other, embrace each other's talents, and to just laugh and have fun. After the talent show, Rachel says, we open our grab bag gifts at midnight. What do you think, Dimitri?
I think that's a pretty good ritual because it elicits a lot of emotion, probably a lot of laughter, and perhaps even embarrassment. But that's in a very controlled environment with people that you already know and love. So sharing emotions is definitely one of the things that rituals are very good at, and that's one of the reasons that they contribute to group bonding, the sharing of emotions.
And it seems like Rachel's ritual of this talent show could be easily passed from one generation to the next.
Absolutely, yes. And also speaking of sharing of emotions, one of the things that we see with collective rituals is that they result in the alignment of emotions. In a study that we did on a far walking ritual in Spain, we actually measured people's physiological responses to the ritual. And we found that during the ritual, people's hearts started beating in synchrony, not just those who actually performed the ritual, but even those who were just watching. So the entire community can reap the benefits of these rituals, of this emotional alignment.
We're talking about traditions, creating opportunities for family togetherness and the things we do together that transfer values, rituals, and beliefs across generations. Dimitri Zigalata stays with us for this conversation. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. You can join in at 800-642-1234. There is a line for you about rituals. What family rituals are part of your life? What traditions have you passed down in your family and you'd like to share? Are there certain traditions that are sticking and others that may not? May just have gone by the wayside. 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return after a check on the news. Gift giving, present exchanges, that's often a tradition many families have. This year, the average shopper said they'd spend north of $1,000 on gifts this year. That's up from $777 last year. We're getting a better sense of where rituals come from and why we hold on to them. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. University of Connecticut anthropologist Dimitri Zigalatis stays with us. You can join in as well about rituals at 800-642-1234. As we come upon New Year's Eve, what traditions do you and your family share? How do your family rituals draw your loved ones together? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dimitri, as we were discussing, there are some rituals that are extreme rituals. What are some examples of extreme rituals?
Well, a lot of my work has focused on these extreme rituals. So I've studied things like fire walking rituals, where people literally walk on fire, or some rituals among Hindu Tamils, where they have to walk on the edges of knives, or they have to pierce their body with multiple needles and even skewers. So there's a wide gamut of these extreme rituals. And they're much more widespread than we might think, actually.
Why are they doing this?
Well, all of our research points to the fact that performing a high-intensity ritual like this brings people closer together, and it makes the individual feel closer to the community. So we have done studies where we looked at charitable giving after the performance of various types of rituals. And we look at collective rituals performed by the same people at the same temple in the island of Mauritius. And we see that when they perform their most painful rituals, the ones that involve things like piercing the body with hooks and needles, or walking barefooted on burning hot asphalt, that's when they give the most. And in fact, they give much more. And the effects of these rituals spread beyond the active performers to the entire community. So on that day that some people, a part of the group engages in this voluntary suffering, the entire community becomes more charitable. They give more money to donation to charities. So you see that the entire community reaps the benefit of this participation.
We also see in
other kinds of studies, we see that engaging in those very painful rituals, which to an outsider might seem excruciating, actually makes participants feel calmer, less stressed afterwards, and even euphoric. Much like we see in marathon runners. This is the phenomenon called the runner's high, this endorphin-mediated effect of feeling euphoric and ecstatic and elated after a very prolonged period of exhaustion. We see the same thing with some of these extreme rituals. So to the individual, perhaps they don't feel as extreme, at least after some time.
I'm thinking of an extreme ritual that many people do here in Wisconsin, jumping into frigid waters of lakes here. Some people, there's even kind of a circuit where you can do these multiple occasions during the winter in Wisconsin. Would that be considered a ritual?
Oh, absolutely. And you have the same types of ritual activities performed or explicitly held as rituals, let's say in Japan, the misoji, where people do exactly this thing. They bathe in ice-cold water, and then they roll around the snow, or they jump into ice-cold water. And again, this is an extreme ritual that where you can see that after its performance, it really creates bonds between people.
What is the link between ritual and superstition?
Well, superstition can be just a belief. Rituals very often include these superstitions, but go beyond them in the sense that they are actually enacted superstitions. A ritual has to involve an action, but the two can very often be combined. And there was actually a very interesting study that looked at the effects of superstitious rituals among baseball players. So they asked the players to cross their fingers behind their back before batting, and they found that this increased their performance. They actually became better at playing the game. And of course, this doesn't happen through any kind of supernatural intervention. The idea here is that, and that's what the study found, is that performing these rituals before the game increased confidence in one's own abilities, and this increased confidence led to better performance. And that's why you see that those areas of life that involve the most superstitions and the most ritualized behavior are typically the ones that have the most, the highest degree of uncertainty, especially areas like gambling and sports, where the outcome is very uncertain, and it certainly doesn't only depend on you. So they help athletes, they help gamblers get a sense of control, get a sense of confidence, which actually might manifest in their performance itself.
We got an email from Jane in La Crosse who says, every time I have a birthday, I journal in my diary and look back over my year and thank God for all he's done for me and all he will do for me. Jane says, it's great reflecting on my previous year and giving thanks for the good and the bad. So there we have a ritual. How can rituals help us look forward to the future, Dimitri?
I think this is a very good example of a personal ritual here, and especially one that is connected to, it's very telling that this is connected to her birthday, because birthdays are threshold moments, right? So we leave a part of us behind and we look forward to something new. So making a note of the good moments and setting goals is a very good way of motivating ourselves, much like we have New Year's resolutions. And why is it for at New Year's that we do that? Well, because that's a threshold moment. It might be completely arbitrary, but in our minds and in our culture, that actually marks the passage from one year to the next. So that is the time to make those resolutions.
Dimitri, as we wrap up here, how can we start a new ritual? What would we need to do that?
Well, I think the best way to start a new ritual is to see what works in the past. When you look at various rituals across the world, they superficially seem to be extremely variable and infinitely so, but there are some things that are common, because at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we have very similar ways of behaving, right? So we'll look at what works in various traditions. So for example, if you want a family ritual, then incorporating a meal is definitely a very good idea. Things that we know from psychological science that work are, for example, engaging in synchronous movement. This tends to increase rapport and increase interpersonal liking. So if you move together, you feel like more that you're acting as a unit, and therefore you feel more that you're part of the group.
Well, Dimitri, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Dimitri Zigalatis is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Connecticut. His piece in The Conversation is titled, An Anthropologist Explains Why We Love Holiday Rituals and Traditions. This New Year's Eve marks the 50th anniversary of the storied Ice Bowl. It still holds the title for the all-time coldest NFL game in the league's history. The Green Bay Packers beat the Dallas Cowboys in the final moments of the game at Lambeau Field. The game had it all action-wise, but it was sub-zero temperature-wise. Patty Murray reports.
Sportscaster Ray Scott summed it up before game time on December 31st, 1967.
And by any yardstick, it's just plain cold. It is indeed cold in Green Bay.
The roughly 58,000 fans at Lambeau Field that day do remember the searing cold, but Packer team historian Cliff Crystal says he and the others all stuck around because of the compelling action.
Well, the weather obviously is what made it different. I mean, a lot of NFL games have been won in the final seconds.
The Packers met the Dallas Cowboys for what was then the NFL Championship, which Crystal says at the time was a bigger deal than the fledgling Super Bowl.
They beat Dallas on a quarterback sneak by Bart Starr with 13 seconds remaining in the game. Just a legendary drive under the conditions.
That sneak gave the Packers a 21-17 win over Dallas. It would be the Packers' third straight NFL championship title, something Crystal says has yet to be repeated to this day. Despite the on-field action, it's the weather that made the Ice Bowl go down in history. Gene Brusky is the science and operations officer for the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Like so many other Green Bay natives, he has an Ice Bowl connection. His father was the team doctor who ended up treating players and referees for frostbite. Brusky says December 1967 started out mild.
In the first half of December, we had sort of this split flow, and that basically kept the air bottled up in Canada, and we were more under the influence of a subtropical jet, which kept us milder. During the second half of December, and as we approached basically the last 12 days of the month, that's where we got into that, what we refer to, if you want to use football jargon, a second half adjustment.
By the morning of the 31st, forecasts predicted cold temperatures, but not to the point of 16 below, which was where the mercury was during game time. The cold prompted older ticket holders to offer seats to younger folks, like Dave Hansen, who now represents Green Bay in the state Senate.
I didn't go out searching for tickets the day before, but when the neighbor came up with them, and at that time when you're 20 years old with not a lot of money, 12 bucks seemed reasonable. But when my mother said, you can't go, it's too cold, I'm saying, hey, $12 is $12.
So Hansen bundled up and sat down on the cold aluminum bleachers to watch the team. He has a dog-eared ice bowl program to prove he was actually at the game that some consider to be the Woodstock of football. That's to say, if everyone who claims to have been there actually was.
December 31st, 1967, million people said they were there, but I was there.
Packer historian Cliff Crystal is willing to cut people some slack.
When people tell me they were at the Ice Bowl, I believe them.
Crystal says back then almost the entire city population could have fit into the stadium. So chances are anyone in Green Bay 50 years ago had a good chance of being at the Ice Bowl. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And we're remembering the Ice Bowl here on The Morning Show. This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Brianne Chasso and Naeja Ellison. Dave Potras provided technical direction. Cheryl Gasser is director of the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's a special Wisconsin Life edition of Wisconsin Weekend. Join us as we hear about some of executive producer Erica Janik's favorite Wisconsin Life pieces. It's a look back. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on The Morning Show.